On the line now, I've got Jason Sanders from the Vaccination Alternative Society of New Zealand. Let's get the music down a bit more and see if the technology is playing ball today. Jason, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. Now, yeah, you're the spokesperson for the Vaccination Alternative Society of New Zealand.
That's right.
And obviously, you guys are not happy with the meningitis vaccine campaign. I presume that's your position.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so now, apparently we're having this campaign to vaccinate everyone in New Zealand under 20 to combat the current meningococcal epidemic. So first of all, can we just define what an epidemic is in New Zealand? Because it sounds like a big thing that's rampant and overrunning the population.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the meningococcal B vaccination campaign is really nearly at the end. They've done most of the children of New Zealand. They aim to vaccinate three times 1.15 million of New Zealand's young people and children, and they've largely succeeded with that. As for a definition of epidemic, I guess there's no really set definition, but I would say by any measure, the epidemic in New Zealand was extremely skimpy, you know. I would argue that isolated outbreaks would be a more accurate term.
Okay.
The reason why I say that is they've actually done surveys during the middle of this epidemic, so-called epidemic, which officially ran from 1991, well, to the present day. And in the late 1990s, they did there was a big study put out by the Waikato Health Board called the Top 10 Report. And what they found was that they totaled up all the statistics they could collate from hospital records, from the Environmental Science and Research Institute, where all these records are kept, and they found that it didn't even, deaths from meningococcal disease from all strains, not just the meningococcal B substrain, which is supposedly what is causing most of the deaths, as far as the health department is saying, what they found is it didn't even break into the top 10 causes of death. You know, like, obviously motor vehicle crashes is number one, but it goes down the list, suicide, sudden infant death syndrome, and meningococcal invasive disease didn't even make it into that top 10.
Okay, well, the Ministry of Health is saying that with this campaign, we're going to save 20 lives a year. Is that a statement you agree with?
No, not at all. Well, first of all, they went to the cabinet when, top officials from the health department went to the cabinet back in the late 90s, I think it was. And they said, oh, look, we've got this huge epidemic and there's about 20 deaths. If we get a vaccine, we can prevent about 20 deaths a year. And, you know, they implied that most of the deaths were from meningococcal B, the substrain, because there's many different types of substrains of this particular bacteria. There's like meningococcal A, there's meningococcal B, meningococcal C, meningococcal W, 1, 3, 5. But in each of those, there's a whole lot of substrains. So there's lots of substrains, you know, meningococcal A.
Okay.
And they said, okay, we can prevent 20 deaths. In fact, the average for every year was probably about 17. And people who have really investigated what percentage of those deaths a year were from the particular substrains have found that the meningococcal B substrain, which is the official epidemic strain, it was probably less than 50%.
Well, the ministry said that it's actually 80%.
Yeah, they did, and that's actually not true. That's a lie. I mean, that's propaganda. That's 80%. Ron Law, who's the guy who's done most of the hours investigation, he's been a former advisor to the Ministry of Health, and he's trained in statistics. He's his job is actually, what is it? He calls himself an independent... I've forgotten the term now. But anyway, he's very well trained in this kind of thing, and he went through all the records and he found that of all the cases that have been collected since 1991, of the confirmed cases, that is, they have actually found out that it was a meningococcal bacteria that probably caused the disease. He's found that about 50%, just under 50%, were caused by the meningococcal B. So
okay.
That's the actual official record.
Okay. Now, the other issue about this 20 lives a year, which is probably a rounding, shall we say, to be generous, from 17 lives a year that have been lost to this.
Well, this was a prediction they were making. They said that if they brought in the vaccine, they would prevent 20 deaths a year.
Okay. Now, the vaccine's been given to only people under the age of 20, so the other question I have is, were those the statistics this is based on, is that just under the under 20 age group?
No, this is the other point I was just about to make, and I'm really glad you've led up to that. Is that what actually they made out, that most of the deaths occurring were in under 20 year olds in New Zealand? That's actually not true either. And probably about, I can't remember the exact figures, but probably about 2/3 or 3/4 of the deaths were actually in people who are older than 20. Now, this is a bit of a revelation, because they've actually made, you know, definitely implied that most of the deaths were under 20-year-olds, and that's why they're going to vaccinate that portion of the population.
Yeah, well, it's an obvious implication of indeed doing that.
Yeah, so. Yeah. But, I mean, for example, just to give you a rough idea of how many deaths were occurring in that age group, in every year in New Zealand, approximately 700 people under 20 die, okay, from all causes. That's from car accidents, from suicide, from, being born very weak as a baby and then dying shortly afterwards. And out of that 700, in the year 2001, which was the peak year for the meningococcal epidemic in New Zealand, that's when there was 26 deaths from all strains of meningococcal bacteria. There are only, Ron Law, this is something Ron Law found out, there are only 2 deaths from meningococcal B in that age group out of that 700. So out of 700 people under 20 in New Zealand who died in 2001, only 2 of them died from the meningococcal B substrain.
Okay. Now.
So that's their 20 deaths. That means that when they brought the vaccine in, if they had brought the vaccine in and they knew that it worked 100%, and by the way, there's no proof that it does work, there's no real proof.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in
a
minute.
Yeah, they could only have prevented 2 deaths.
And they're spending how much on this campaign?
Oh, the government sources have said $200 million New Zealand.
So that's $100 million per life.
Yeah. Well, no, not really, because that's only per year. But it's a lot of millions per death.
Right, okay. Now, let's talk about how well does it work? How well does the vaccine work?
Well, this is the other thing. When they actually bring out a vaccine, you know, normally you do trials on stuff. But by the way, all vaccines have, when they have trials, the trials are often very shonky and the follow-up times are very short. I know that the MMR vaccine, that's the measles, mumps and rubella vaccine, when it was brought out in England, they did trials in the late 1980s, and there was a lot of criticism by medical scientists who have done papers, who published papers in journals on this, and saying that the follow-up times, which were often only 48 hours, but a lot of them were also 3 weeks, and a few were 4 weeks, they said that 3 weeks was not long enough to follow up. And this makes sense scientifically, because vaccines have toxins in them, and we know that from toxin-related poisoning cases, that they can do their damage over a period of time afterwards. You don't just die within a couple of days if you get mercury poisoning. You can die 9 months later.
Okay, so that example you've given in the UK, they were doing 3, maybe 4 weeks for their follow-up period.
At most.
Yeah, was there that sort of research done on this vaccine, and how long was it?
Well, yeah, but this is the thing. You see, there's been a lot of criticism of the MMR vaccine trials in England, and New Zealand bases, we use the MMR in New Zealand based on overseas countries like the UK using their vaccine. But the trials, this was a unique substrain of the meningococcal B, and so they couldn't just use a vaccine from overseas from another country. They had to get one that was specific to New Zealand. So they supposedly did trials in New Zealand looking at about 1,600 children and teenagers, and the follow-up time was only 7 days. So they're only looking at side effects officially for 7 days following vaccination, which is pretty pathetic time.
Have they said why 7 days, why they think 7 days is adequate?
No, they don't Well, they just seem to, you know, imply, I guess, that 7 days is an adequate time. And I think the ministry officials would probably defend that 7 days by saying, oh, well, during the actual rollout of the vaccine, that we had a hospital-based monitoring system which was going to collect any data from children who, you know, who are getting side effects, so they could tell, you know, after a few months what the side effect ratio was.
Okay, well, that's kind of treating the rollout as the test.
Exactly. I mean, you know, and the thing is, I know for a fact that there are children who got very, very sick, and it really is reliant on whether their GP agrees that it might be vaccine related.
And what are the attitudes of GPs to that issue?
Well, I can only give you one example. I came across a mother whose two little toddlers got very adversely affected, and she, I mean, look, the little girl, after the second dose, about a week later after the second dose, the little girl was waking up in the middle of the night constantly, not being able to go back to sleep, and she was back arching and screaming at the top of her lungs so loudly that her next door neighbours were coming over in the middle of the night. And this went on for about a month or 5 weeks. Now, this mother was beside herself. I mean, her little boy, who was a little bit older, he was also having major behavioural changes, and he didn't eat for the first week after the vaccine. And she went to an emergency doctor, I think with a little girl it was, and, you know, mentioned the vaccination and how this happened very shortly afterwards. And the guy just said, oh, you know, that was probably just tummy ache. Gave her some pills for that. And she eventually did go to her normal GP, a woman doctor, and the woman doctor also dismissed out of hand any possible vaccine connection. And she said, oh, it was probably they were teething.
Okay, I've heard of research done in the States where they estimate that doctors only report about 10% of vaccine injuries. So
that's right. Even the doctors themselves, like the Center for Disease Control in the USA, and that's the equivalent of the health department over there, they admit that probably 10% is almost a generous figure for the amount of reporting going on of vaccine injuries.
Yeah, okay. We were talking about how well the vaccine works. What are the ministry's statistics on that? What does their research show the vaccine has been effective, and what do you have to say about that?
Well, there is no research. I mean, before the rollout, in this country, you have to get approval, you have to get a license for every medicine or vaccine that gets put out onto the market for the general public's use. And MedSafe is the agency which is supposedly the watchdog, the official watchdog, and it actually gives approval for licensing. And the actual committee, the MAAC Vaccine Subcommittee, I'm not sure what MAAC stands for, but they're the subcommittee that was supposed to give the go-ahead for this particular meningococcal B vaccine. And they were saying in papers that Ron Law managed to get hold of under the Official Information Act, they were saying, just before it got licensed, they were saying that they had grave misgivings about this particular vaccine, that there was no efficacy data. Efficacy data is basically scientific trials proving that this vaccine does prevent meningococcal invasive disease. And they were saying, you know, look, here's an actual quote from the minutes from their meeting. There are a number of issues relating to the manufacturing and quality data that are to be addressed by Chiron. Chiron was the transnational corporation that made the vaccine. And they also, the expert committee's conclusion was that the current data supplied provides very limited data on its effectiveness, and evidence of efficacy is not compelling. They went on to say that the committee was concerned that there was no efficacy data for the proposed vaccine, and were not convinced that the efficacy and safety monitoring during the rollout was sufficient to maintain public safety and confidence.
This is from the minutes of the committee that was deciding whether the vaccine should be released.
That's the official minutes.
So why was the vaccine released if they were that worried?
That's a good question, isn't it? Okay. The very next day, apparently.
Nobody knows then.
Nobody really knows. It's all a mystery. It's all in some sort of Orwellian black hole. The very next day, the minister approved Chiron's MENZB vaccine. That's the official name of the vaccine.
You presume that was a political decision.
You would presume. I think you'd safely presume they had their arm twisted behind their backs.
Yeah.
In a press statement announcing approval, the minister, that's Annette King, said MedSafe is assured that the vaccine is safe and effective given all the information currently available to it, which was very, very little.
I haven't heard this about this those minutes yet. I didn't expect to hear about it in the mainstream media, I have to admit.
No, you would not expect to hear about it in the mainstream media, but that's the official minutes. And you can find that if you want, if any of your listeners are interested. This was put out in an article called The Meningococcal Gold Rush by Ron Law and Barbara Sumner Burston. Barbara Sumner Burston was a journalist who collaborated with Ron Law. And it's still up on the website of, well, it's on our website. No, sorry. It's on scoop.co.nz. If you do a search on scoop.co.nz, you'll be able to find it.
Okay. All right. Now, the ministry actually says that the efficacy rate is 57%. What's that about? I mean, they sound pretty confident.
Efficacy rate? I haven't actually heard that. Is this a recent declaration?
No. I think it's based on the Norwegian, the parent vaccine.
Right. Yep, that's true. They did. You see, this vaccine is based on a vaccine that was developed in Norway. Norway had a similar epidemic to New Zealand during the 1980s, and they spent about $100 million doing proper trials, unlike the trials here, long-term trials, and tests on about 180,000 adolescents. And about 80,000 of those children or teenagers, they got this Norwegian vaccine tested on them. The others got a placebo. And what they found was that after about 2.5 years, they averaged out the rates of meningococcal invasive disease that the adolescents who got the vaccine compared it to the placebo group who didn't get the vaccine. And they found that there was like a 57% lesser rate of meningococcal invasive disease. But what the New Zealand government or the Ministry of Health doesn't go on to say is that they never actually used the Norwegian vaccine in that country because they decided that 57% was a pretty poor efficacy rate. And
So is this vaccine being used in New Zealand the same as the Norwegian one? Can we directly transfer those figures?
Well, no, they're really different vaccines. And I mean, the fact is they found that the Norwegian vaccine was too ineffective to be used. And also their epidemic and so-called epidemic, because I think it wasn't that bad, had waned a lot by the time they had actually finally done the trials, so they never went ahead. But it was also considered, I mean, it was published in The Lancet, which is a very prestigious medical journal in England, and they basically said, you know, not effective enough. So what's interesting about that Norwegian vaccine is that Chiron, when it won the contract to do the big vaccination campaign in New Zealand, when they did the trials, they actually used the vaccine that was manufactured in Norway in the trials. They didn't actually use the vaccine that Chiron was manufacturing for the actual rollout. Now, that's pretty shonky practice. Normally, because they're considered to be separate vaccines, you should do the trials on using the actual vaccine that was manufactured.
So you're saying the trials they did with the 1,600 New Zealand children with a 7-day trial period was based on a different vaccine?
Yeah, it was based on the parent. I mean, they actually used the leftover vaccines from the Norwegian public health laboratory that was manufactured there. They didn't actually use the vaccines which were manufactured by Chiron in its Italian plant, which were the ones they used in the rollout. So there was a different vaccine used in the trials to the ones that were actually used in the rollout. Now, that is very, very shonky science.
Well, I presume that if we ask the ministry about this, they'd defend it by saying, well, it is the parent vaccine, you know, the New Zealand one's based on it, they're quite similar it's perfectly reasonable, etc., etc.
Yeah, except that that's been contradicted by the Minister of Health's Annette King's own words. An answer to a question by National's Dr. Linda Scott on the 28th of May 2003, the Minister of Health, Annette King, is on record and in parliamentary records as saying New Zealand will not acquire the intellectual property rights to the vaccine. That's the vaccine that Chiron was manufacturing, because New Zealand does not have manufacturing experience in producing outer membrane vesicle vaccines. If this were indeed possible, repeated clinical trials would need to happen in New Zealand for the production of MENZB. When a vaccine, and these are the key words here, when a vaccine is produced at a new manufacturing plant site, it is deemed for clinical reasons a new vaccine and would require a full clinical investigation and license application. So in her own words, she's saying that a vaccine that's manufactured in a separate plant by a separate organisation is a new vaccine.
Okay. Shot herself in the foot.
Well, she didn't know that a couple of years down the track, someone like Ron Law was going to come along and investigate this kind of thing.
Okay, so does anybody know how effective this vaccine is, or if it's even effective at all? Anybody anywhere?
Well, I don't think anyone really knows. I mean, the thing is, Aaron, it's very... I don't think we should really trust the way they collate evidence in this country. You know, like, they'll say... They can bring out a figure, a statistic, and it sounds really good, and everyone's going to sort of think, well, that's the official word, you know? So that's the truth. But if it's based on doctors who aren't even recognising a connection between, you know... quite often doctors, you know, if a child's vaccinated and they get a disease that they're vaccinated against, it's quite easy by a kind of sleight of hand to actually assign that to another disease. And especially with something like meningococcal disease, which invasive disease, which can look similar to other diseases, you know.
Well, I presume that most doctors don't think that the vaccine's going to cause any damage anyway. They wouldn't be expecting to get that coming into their clinic.
Well, I mean, that's another issue, that's the side effects, but if we're talking about efficacy, which is you're asking me about, it's just very easy to sort of say, you know, because quite often with meningococcal invasive disease, they don't even, a child comes in, they're really sick, they don't always have time to sort of do a lumbar puncture or to find out if there's bacteria, they just have to treat them. By the time they've treated them with antibiotics, they've destroyed the evidence. You often can't find the bacteria after that, you know, especially if it was a mild case. So it's there's a lot of grey areas, you know, in this kind of research. But to give you an example of what the sort of kind of thing that happens, there was a little girl called Caitlin in South Auckland last year, and she was on the front page of the Herald because she died from meningococcal invasive disease. Now, when the family first went to the medical authority, you know, the doctors, and said that their child was sick and they took her to the hospital, when the doctors in the hospital found out that she'd been vaccinated three times with the meningococcal B vaccine, just a couple months beforehand, they didn't even investigate the idea. They could not believe that she had meningococcal invasive disease, so they just they didn't treat her straight away. And it was only when she became very, very, very sick that they realised that she did have meningococcal invasive disease.
So
she ended up dying.
The doctors have actually... Yeah, well, that's pretty shocking, but it also shows the doctors have an implicit belief that vaccines are actually 100% effective.
Well, that's right, they do.
And all the I know that all the information put out by vaccine manufacturers shows that they know that their vaccines aren't 100% effective. Even in their wildest dreams, they wouldn't believe that.
There's no medicines that are 100% effective. It's a ridiculous notion.
But clearly, the doctors, by their behaviour, shows that they think they are.
That's exactly right. I mean, vaccines have got this aura of invincibility.
Sorry, I'm the one meant to be asking the questions. You're giving the answers here. I'm just
not at all.
Shocked by that. Yeah.
You know, it's not shocking, really. Once you find out these things, you realise that doctors do this all the time. They certainly do it with whooping cough. Whooping cough can be very easily dismissed as just another cough. And there's often, in New Zealand, there's large outbreaks of whooping cough, and the local doctors will, if a child's been vaccinated five times against whooping cough, which they're supposedly by the age of five they will have been, doctors will just don't do the blood tests. They don't do the swabs. Right. And that child, I mean, whooping cough doesn't always have to be a really terrible cough that goes on for months and months and has a whoop in it. It can often be a fairly mild cough. That's a lot of people don't realise this. You can have whooping cough and have a cough for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, just like anything, you can have it in a mild form.
Exactly. And so they just don't do the swabs. But if a child who's unvaccinated comes into the office and has the same cough at the same time when this outbreak is occurring, then that child will get the blood tests and will get the swabs.
Yeah.
And then this will make it look like that the unvaccinated children, you know, are the ones who are bringing the disease in, and they're the ones who are getting it. In fact, fully vaccinated children are getting whooping cough all the time in this country.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, going back to your original question about the meningococcal invasive disease vaccine, the meningococcal B vaccine, yeah, whether it works. Last year, most children were probably, they started the rollout in, I think, around about August or July of 2004. So last year, a lot of the children aged under 20 in New Zealand would have been vaccinated. And yet, the actual rate of death from meningococcal invasive disease from all strains went up last year from 2004. So
that's quite recent information.
Yeah, well, the actual death rate, I think it was about 6 or 7 from memory in 2004. It was higher than that last year.
Okay.
So it started to go up. Now they say it's from all strains, and that the meningococcal B strain, the death rate is less, but it's very easy to, you know, sign another strain.
Yeah. Now, we're talking about these different strains. I think people might be a little shocked to discover that the vaccine actually only theoretically protects for one of four strains. But now you wrote an article in Uncensored magazine about this this campaign, and I was horrified to discover that you're talking there about the fact that meningitis can actually, or the disease can actually, the bacteria can morph between different strains.
Oh, absolutely. It's swaps genotypes, and this is official. You know, this is in the New Zealand Immunisation Handbook, which is the official booklet published by the Ministry of Health every 5 or so years. And Professor Diana Lennon, who's a leading paediatrician in this country, writes most of that. And she admits, I mean, it's just well known amongst all scientists who investigate meningococcal bacteria, that they can easily swap genotypes, which means that a particular, say, meningococcal C subtype, because it's not just meningococcal C, there are dozens of different types of meningococcal C bacteria, they can swap to another meningococcal C subtype, or they could even swap to a meningococcal B or a meningococcal A subtype. And once they've done that, obviously, any vaccine that comes along and is aimed at that strain specific, like the meningococcal B one that was used in this country, it's not going to have any effect whatsoever. That is, if it even was effective against that substrain in the first place, because we're not even sure about that.
Well, you also talked about in the UK where they actually did some research into this after an immunisation campaign there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, 1999, they did a national campaign a little bit similar to here, except it was a meningococcal C strain, which was supposedly the culprit in causing most of the deaths and sickness in the UK. And they went ahead and did this huge campaign, and the death rate actually went up in the following years. And that was, but, you know, the authorities were saying, well, you know, the vaccine was successful because, you know, the deaths from that particular strain, the C strain, which we aimed at, is less. But the overall death rate and the overall sickness rate went up, and that's simply because the bacteria probably swapped to another another strain.
Okay, and so that...
The other thing, too, to mention is that every time you get a vaccine, you're getting injected into this little child all these toxins and foreign proteins.
Well, let's talk about that. What is in the average vaccine? Let's talk about what's in this vaccine.
I'll just get to that. But the thing is, when you inject all these toxins and these foreign proteins into the blood, directly into the bloodstream of a child, you're interfering with the immune system. You're putting a strain on it. And it takes a lot of vitamins, like vitamin C. It'll sap your vitamin C reserves as they try and fight off and get rid of all these toxins. And this actually depletes the vitality of the child. And if that's, in the middle of winter, when your body's under a little bit more strain than normal anyway, you're going to be more susceptible to getting diseases like meningococcal invasive disease. And so it's well known amongst vaccine manufacturers, they put this in their product inserts for their vaccines, that there's a window period after vaccination when a child is actually more susceptible to getting meningitis. So meningitis is actually listed as a side effect from vaccinations. So, that's another reason why that the rates of meningococcal invasive disease in the UK might have gone up. It's probably another reason why they went up last year in New Zealand. Because, you're making children sick. We heard so many reports of children becoming very, very sick, that little toddlers not being able to walk for 3 days after their shots, children getting bedwetting again.
What should someone do? Say there's a few people out there, their kids have had one or two of the shots already, and they're having that kind of alarming reaction, or even slightly alarming reaction. What's the advice for them?
I'm not a doctor, so I can't really give official advice or anything, but yep. we very much believe the Vaccination Alternative Society, which is my group, and also the Immunisation Awareness Society, they're another big group, they're a bigger group than us in New Zealand, we always advise people to make informed decisions, and you just need to get as much information as possible, and unfortunately, you don't really get the full picture from the health authorities in this country. It's very, very one-sided information. It's really just propaganda. And so we would suggest that you go and do your own research, go onto websites, and or ring us up. We have a phone number.
Yep, let's have that.
Yeah, our number is 0832491 78. That's 0832491 78. And the Immunisation Awareness Society, they're in the phone book, in the white pages.
Yep.
And just, find out what you can. And then, if you feel that your child has had some side effects and they're suspiciously close to the vaccination time, we believe that should be reported to the doctor. And if the doctor doesn't want to report it, because there is a reporting agency that collects information on side effects, it's down in Dunedin. I think it's called the Centre for Adverse Reactions Monitoring. Calm. There's actually your doctor should have a form that can be filled out, and you don't have to absolutely prove that the vaccine caused it. You just have to say that these side effects seem to be occurring just after the vaccine, and that should be reported. Unfortunately, a lot of doctors won't want to do that, and some will even refuse.
But you don't need to do it with your doctor.
You don't need your doctor's consent. You can actually apply for that form from the Ministry of Health yourself, and you can fill it out yourself. And unfortunately, it seems to be the psychology of a lot of parents. They don't like doing that. They don't like going up against the system. But if we're ever to get some kind of record of what's been going on, that needs to be done.
Yeah. All right. Now let's talk about this, the bacteria that causes meningitis. Apparently, it's present in 45% of the population at any given moment.
Yep.
So I have a little bit of a maths problem with that. That's nearly 2 million people, but only a few people are getting the disease. So what's the story with this?
Well, the story is that to say that the actual bacteria is the main cause of meningococcal invasive disease is probably a bit of a misnomer, because so many people are carriers who never get it. And we probably need to look at why a very small minority of people who've got these bacteria as passengers in their tonsils because that's the figure. You get that 45% from doing tonsillectomies, apparently. They've taken the tonsils out. If you do a swab of the nasal passages, only about 10% of people will seem to have the bacteria in their bodies.
Which is still a heck of a lot more than get the disease.
Exactly, so. Exactly. But the 45% figure, which is considered to be more scientifically accurate, is when they've actually looked at the tonsil tissues and they've found the bacteria in 45% of any given population. So why do most people never get it? I mean, in your lifetime, you've got a tiny, tiny chance of ever coming down with meningococcal invasive disease. And what they seem to be finding is that the people who do get really sick usually have, it's associated with poverty. South Auckland, it's no fluke that South Auckland children seem to have the much higher rates than European children from middle class backgrounds.
Yeah.
And since a lot of studies show that children or adults who've got very low reserves of vitamin C in their body, they're the ones who seem to be much more susceptible to getting the disease, because vitamin C is just so incredibly vital to your resistance.
So it's really what might be called environmental factors that are tipping kids over the edge into actually getting the disease.
Absolutely. You know, I've met a couple of adults who've had meningococcal invasive disease, you know, and it's not a pretty disease if you get it reasonably severely. And both of these women admitted that they had been under a lot of stress for a long period of time, you know, and they hadn't been eating very well before they got the disease. And one woman I'm thinking of, she was in her late 30s or mid-30s in England, and she's living in a very polluted English city. She was getting colds every 6 weeks. She was getting asthma. Her marriage was breaking up.
Yeah.
She was under a lot of stress at work. She said she had stopped eating well. You know, she wasn't eating very well. So I imagine her body was incredibly depleted of vitamin C as well as other vitamins and minerals.
But
and
basically,
that's when
we're,
she got it.
Basically, we're talking about stuff that puts strain on the immune system. So it's almost like the advice to prevent this is the same advice you give for almost anything else.
You know, we always say our slogan for the Vaccination Alternative Society is good health is the best immunity. Good
right.
health is the best immunity. And, you know, if your diet's great, you're taking a bit of vitamin C supplementation and you don't smoke, you don't live in a house that's very, very damp, you really, unless you've got a rare sort of genetic inheritance of being very prone to meningococcal invasive disease, your chances are incredibly slim. You'd probably never get it, you know. Maybe some of the listeners can remember the little girl, Charlotte Cleverly Bisley, you know, who's been on TV a lot. You know,
yep.
The little girl who lost her limbs?
Yeah.
Now, she was presented in the media, the mainstream media, as being from a really poor, from a middle-class background on Waiheke Island, you know. And when people think of Waiheke Island, they think, oh, you know, there's quite a few wealthy people there. There's vineyards stuff like that. But from what I hear from the sources from Waiheke Island, I know a few people who live, you know, on Waiheke Island. She came from quite a poor background, and both her parents smoked. And that is another factor that's apparently passive smoking isn't, you know, depletes your vitamin C levels. So if her mother had smoked during her pregnancy, that's another risk factor.
Yep.
And there is some evidence that, you know, she possibly may have done that. She's a smoker herself.
Yeah, it seems likely.
And this is the whole thing about the mainstream media. They never went and did the proper background investigation of that story. They just presented her the way the Ministry of Health wanted it to be presented.
Well, look, let's talk about the mainstream media coverage. I know I was reading an editorial in The Listener a few months ago, and they claimed that, I think the deputy editor wrote this editorial. He said that a lot of people had written to them saying, you know, we trust The Listener, and what does The Listener think about this? And they said, basically, we've looked at it, and you really need to have the vaccine. But it's also noticeable the media turned down, the Listener turned down an article which you mentioned before by, was it Helen
Barbara
Summer-Burston?
Barbara
Summer-Burston.
Yeah.
And they also, it seemed to me that they were, if you read The Listener regularly, you notice that the letters to the editor are very well informed in The Listener. And I was really amazed to see that there was not one letter that was attacking the meningitis vaccine campaign. Yeah. Oh, there was one. It was by a mother who said that she just didn't feel that it was right.
Right.
And I thought, surely someone's been sending them letters. So I asked Jonathan Eisen, I said, surely you sent one. And he said, yeah, he had.
He probably sent dozens.
Yeah, he probably flooded them, and then he would bring them to ask why they hadn't been published.
I sent a couple of letters, and they certainly were, never got published.
Yeah, so basically, it seems like the listener, as one example, has decided that it's going to.
Yeah, isn't that sad?
They don't seem to be being objective, which is their main claim.
It's a really good illustration of the level of debate and intellectual debate and censorship in New Zealand, isn't it? I mean, The Listener is supposedly an intellectual magazine. It's New Zealand's sort of premier intellectual magazine in terms of, it's got wide circulation.
Yep.
And it couldn't even allow us to make up our own minds on an issue like that.
Yeah, they didn't think...
Where there was a lot of, there was actually a lot of controversy, and they decided that we were too unintelligent and immature to actually be able to sort out the facts for ourselves.
Yeah.
So they're going to give one side of the story.
Yeah, and I should say that they did... After a while, they did publish some critical letters, but it was only after some debate had begun to appear elsewhere in the mainstream.
Yeah. Yeah, the amount of letters they would have buried would have been pretty high, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, even the New Zealand Herald, which has a great habit of burying letters on this subject from the other side, from our side, even they published a couple of my letters.
Right.
So they're doing better than the New Zealand Listener.
Interesting.
It's pretty sad.
Yeah.
But they had that Deputy Itoa, he's an ex-doctor as well, so I don't know if that was a factor, but he's trained in medicine, yeah.
He didn't disclose that piece of information in his editorial, I don't believe.
No, he didn't.
I was totally unaware of that.
Sure. But, that's the way it goes. I mean, just reading his letter, him saying that, we're not going to allow you to have this other argument. Is very, very patronising,
Yeah.
It's very, very almost patriarchal,
Yeah. Now, you have published an article, of course, in Uncensored magazine. Has there been any reaction to this? Or what sort of feedback have you got?
Well, I haven't actually heard any feedback about it, but I have heard, people like you have read it, and I have heard a few other people who have been, impressed by the facts there. I mean, the facts speak for themselves.
It's a quite a long article, and it had a lot of information. I'd read up quite well on this, I thought, but you still had a bit of information in there, quite a bit, that I hadn't been aware of.
Yeah.
I've got it right here next to me, actually. There's about 8 pages, so
sure?
If people want to get informed. In fact, we should talk about this. It's in the first issue of Uncensored magazine, which is sold out. So is there some way that people can get a copy of this article?
I'm not actually sure, but... That was an edited version of another article I wrote, which is probably, to be honest, a little bit more accurate, because it was quite edited down.
Okay.
So my slightly longer version of that article is on our website, if people want to read that.
Okay, what's your website address, Jason?
Our website address is beyondvaccines, which is one word, .vibrantplanet, which is one word, .com. Okay. If you just Google and Beyond Vaccines, you'll get our website quite easily.
Okay, yeah, that'd guarantee people will get it. Okay, now...
Anyway, I've actually got another article which was a little bit later and probably a little bit more up to date, and that's called A Summing Up of the 2004-2005 Meningococcal B campaign.
Okay, and that's on the website
well. That's on the same website. So that's quite good. I actually probably, if anything, I prefer that article.
Okay, now, what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, in the article you talked about you tried to track down, there had been some infants or small young children that appeared to have died following the administration of the vaccine, and you hadn't received any information back. You'd asked for information from the ministry about it.
Not the ministry, no.
No, from?
No, no, from parents. I mean, okay. When you hear a rumour,
yep.
All you can do is just tell the person you've who knows the people, has heard of the people, to put it to them there if they'd like to call us up.
Okay, at the time of writing this article, you hadn't heard back from any of them. Have you heard?
No.
From any, you haven't?
No. It's quite difficult because, there are a few people removed from me, and a lot of people, when they've just had a child die, their own child,
yeah,
they just go in on themselves, you know. It's, there's a real psychology involved, and
yeah, it's going to be a year or so before they come out of.
Oh, it's just a lifetime, you know. Yeah. Parents who lose their own child, especially if they feel it was from something they could have prevented, you know, like a vaccine, if they suspect that. There's a huge amount of guilt. It's just so hard. It takes a remarkable parent, you know, to sort of really want to go public on that kind of thing or go up against the system, you know, because the system is going to make life unpleasant.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
I've spoken on the phone with a mother who definitely, I think, her child died from the MMR vaccine back in 1997 because they did a school-based MMR vaccination campaign, you know, against measles, mumps and rubella. Well, supposedly there was going to be a measles epidemic, and the authorities said, okay, we have to go and vaccinate the MMR, all the children in the schools. Now, this mother who was in Taupo, her little boy came home that day after being given the MMR, and he was not the same. From that day onwards, he went downhill, and he got very, very sick and had a lot of different symptoms. She took him to the doctor. The doctor refused to investigate any connection with the MMR vaccine. He said the MMR vaccine cannot cause that. And anyway, the boy eventually got so sick that they flew him by helicopter from Taupo to Waikato Hospital. And he was on death's door. And they, when she got there, because the mother was in the helicopter with him, she said to the doctors, you know, look, it was the vaccine. The vaccine did this. And she said that she felt she was treated very, very shabbily. And they just refused to admit that possibility, and the boy died. They buried him, and she said what was unusual about it was that they didn't do a proper autopsy. But she's adamant that he died from the MMR. But her husband, for example, he refuses to talk about it.
Which is kind of understandable, too.
People react in different ways. I mean, I personally think that they... I know it's tough, but to think about all the other children who could be dying from it, you know? And I think it's almost like a public duty to go public.
Yeah.
And go to the media. What's really amazing about this lady is that she did go public in the end, because in 2001, which was when I spoke to her, there was another school-based MMR vaccination campaign, and she decided to go public, and she went to the local newspaper in Taupo, and they ran a paper, and they ran a story on it.
Right.
Not a very good story, because they didn't, you know, really investigate too much from our side, our point of view, and they tended to quote, you know, the official sort of spokesperson's view a lot, but they did give a little bit of coverage to the mother.
Yeah. Okay, now I just want to talk about the emotive aspect of this current campaign. They appear to be pushing a lot of emotional buttons on people. Have you got any comments to make on that?
Well,
or any examples, perhaps. I'm not that well informed about the various examples of what they've done, but
well, I think people need to really wake up to the way propaganda is, and the way media campaigns can manipulate your emotions. And fear is always a good one, a really great button to push. Fear, you know, like if a country wants to go to war against another country, they will always try and build up the other country as being dangerous, you know, like the USA did with Iraq.
Yeah.
When it went into, it couldn't invade Iraq without saying that it was really dangerous, so they had to start saying, oh, you know, Saddam Hussein, he's got weapons of mass destruction, he's an evil, evil dictator. And then, only then can you get the groundswell of support to go and invade. And as we all know, that's all turned out to be a pack of lies. But the thing is with this campaign, yeah, they were saying some extraordinary things which were completely at variance with the actual facts. Like, you know, I'd be driving around town, I'd see on the back of buses a meningococcal B sort of campaign advertising saying death sucks. That was the main heading. Now that's just going to...
It's not information,
no. It's just a big emotive slogan, which is going to, you know, really worry parents.
That's
parents
quite
of little
remarkable,
children.
Actually. But people tend to accept it.
They tend to, yeah. People seem to just take at the word, you know, government agencies. It's really, really sad. I guess they have a lot of kudos, don't they, government agencies? We think that they're there for us. that they're not going to be irresponsible.
Well, that is what they tell us.
Yeah, I mean, death sucks. I mean, so they're making our, you know, and then they had people going on TV saying, like, Dr. Nikki Turner, who's from the Immunisation Advisory Centre, which is based in the Auckland University.
Yeah.
Now, the Immunisation Advisory Centre have a lot of, a certain amount of kudos because they're part of the Auckland Medical School, and they get funding from the New Zealand government. That's from you and me, from our taxes. And they also, what a lot of people don't realise is they get a lot of funding from the vaccine manufacturers themselves. They get some very large grants. And anyway, she's going on TV and she's going on the radio and she's saying, well, look, children are in great danger of losing their limbs. Look at Charlotte, cleverly busily, and they're in great danger of dying. And the implication is that you're a very irresponsible parent if you don't go ahead and get this government-endorsed vaccine.
Well, what we've got here is people who call themselves scientists and certainly believe themselves to be scientists behaving in quite an emotive way. What's going on? Let's look at this. Like the entire profession and most of the scientists are fairly united behind this idea that vaccines are perfectly safe and that we need to take them because it's going to prevent disease. And it's this big united front, and it appears very plausible. And you're saying if people go and do some research, they'll find out something different.
But it's actually a big controversy. It's not totally united, not at all.
Okay.
There are doctors and there are medical scientists who are speaking out. And they do so at a big risk to their careers too, you know, because they can be dismissed and lose chances of promotion. Very few doctors in this country have spoken out against the meningococcal B or questioned it. And that's simply because, you know, Big Brother's going to come down on them. You know, it's very... There was a doctor down in Dunedin. He was a professor of general practice in the Otago University Medical School, Dr. Campbell Murdoch, and he spoke out and he questioned vaccination. He said that it was a sacred cow to the medical profession and that it wasn't very scientific, that no one could have any doubts about vaccinations. And he's also... he really did question it. But, you know, the way he did it was very clever. He did it at a conference. He stood up at a conference and did this little speech. And then he'd retired from his job there, and he went and got a job in one of the, I think it was in Dubai, or United Arab Emirates, in a medical establishment over there. So he could get out. He had to leave the country, basically, because he knew his name just was going to be mud from that point onwards.
That's pretty extreme, that is.
Yep. It is, and when he left that job, you know, it was quite a lucrative job for a few years over in the Middle East. He couldn't get a job in New Zealand when he came back, and the only job he could get was in the outback in Australia, where, you know, they probably struggled to get any doctor at all.
They are desperate for staff over there.
That's right. So he's working now in the outback in Australia because he won't be able to get a job in any mainstream medical establishment in probably mainstream Australia or New Zealand.
Yeah. Okay, I want to ask also some questions about you personally. I always like to ask people this. What has motivated you to get active on this issue?
Well,